our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Amy Adams.
Hi, Amy. How are we going?
Hello. Good. How are you going?
Yeah, pretty good. It's been a day. Nice and sunny over in Auckland.
Oh, really? No, it's gone dog again here in the South Island.
Oh,
rainy
no.
And cloudy and cold. And a week out from summer.
Well, I mean, you just need that good contrast to get you ready for the summer.
I guess so. And you don't mind not being on holiday yet when it's miserable.
Exactly. You'd rather have it when you're away and have the time to enjoy it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. So, we'll jump in. Proposals for online voting papers, that's just been something that's been talked about recently. I'm curious as to what your stance is on it.
Yeah, it's something we looked at quite closely in government. I think first of all, there's a lot of people who sort of talk about online voting as some sort of magic bullet to deal with low engagement and low turnout. And the countries that have taken on online voting have found that it doesn't magically see everyone a lot more engaged in the political process, which I think, to be honest, is the real goal. So I think, first of all, we can't assume that it's going to sort of be a instant panacea or a significant change in those numbers. There are, of course, real concerns about the security of online voting systems and how that works. When we're in government, we set up a process for local government to trial it if they want to. And a number of councils were keen to do it and started working on proposals and platforms, but in the end gave it away because they found it simply too hard to get it all in place. Now, whether they're going to have another go, I don't know. But I think in the future, if we can absolutely satisfy ourselves as to the integrity and the security of that process, then it's worth looking at. But at the same time, I wouldn't be holding my breath that somehow it will magically address issues of low voter engagement, particularly amongst young voters, because that hasn't been experienced overseas. In fact, some countries overseas that have gone to online voting are now unwinding it, I understand. So it's not without its own problems.
Absolutely. Security is the big thing there. How do you think you'd go about potentially targeting that as an issue in this matter?
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually had a look. I was in Estonia, a few years ago now, when I was communications and IT minister. And one of the things I looked at over there is their online voting system, because they have a really good system. And the reason that they're able to make it work is that, you know, obviously Estonia came out of the Soviet bloc, and so there are different sort of sets of cultural norms. But every citizen there carries a microchipped ID card. And so what they're able to do is you insert your microchipped ID card into the card reader at the computer. There's then a two-factor authentication process where, you know, your cell phone is texted a number and you confirm that it's you and the like. And then they can vote on that basis. And that works well for them. But I personally don't think New Zealand would want to go down that road of every citizen having to carry a microchipped ID card. And so, without that, it puts us in a very different starting position. So I think it's a significant issue and one that can't be glossed over. The other thing is, if we look at the census, was it this year or at the end of last year? I think it was this year, where we've gone to a much greater use of online census forms, which I personally liked. It makes it very convenient. But actually, we've seen a massive number of people who just got missed out and it didn't work for. So I think it's something that we should keep looking at and keep in mind. But I think with democracy, it's right at the heart of how our system works. We can't rush into something unless we know that it's going to work safely and consistently for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's being proposed at the minute by the person who's put this forward is people using their phone numbers and then getting voting papers in the mail and all that kind of stuff. And that kind of seems problematic to me in the long term.
Yeah, I mean, local council sort of works that way with mailed out voting papers that you then sort of fill in and codes and the like. But there have been a number of examples of voter fraud, unfortunately, with any sort of postal vote system. And actually, probably local council voting has, we assessed a lower level of voter integrity just because of the use of mailed out voting papers, which is why we thought actually that was a better place to trial it, because even though there are security issues with online, it could have been a less bad alternative to what we had at the moment for local government. But I agree with you. I think, you know, those sorts of systems with cell phone numbers and mailed out voting papers, we just know there's a myriad of different family dynamics and controls and things going on, and we just don't know what happens if people are voting behind the closed door, as it were.
Sorry about that little buzzing in the background.
That's right.
And I think when we think about low participation, there's more than just people having access. It's that political engagement you're talking
Absolutely.
About. Yeah, so,
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you go about emphasizing that?
And to me, that's always been at the heart of it. I think we're not being fair to ourselves as a country. We're not addressing the real issue if we just look at what's the voter turnout. Because, look, anybody can turn up and you know, sort of do a protest vote or put a cross through everything or do whatever, and some do, which is why I've never been a fan of compulsory voting, because you can't force people to be engaged. And I think it's engagement that is the true goal in participatory democracies. So I don't think there's a silver bullet to it, and there's no doubt that people become more engaged as they go on in life. You know, all the stats for many, many years have shown that younger people obviously are not as engaged, and as they get older, they become more engaged. But we'd love to see younger people more engaged and thinking about the issues and taking the time to understand what's at stake, understand what the various parties and candidates represent, and making an informed decision. Sometimes people talk about, you know, that sort of civics being taught at schools. I must say, I always make a point of going around all of the schools I can and talking to their Year 13 classes and meeting with school groups at Parliament, just to try and get them thinking about how easy it is to get engaged in politics in New Zealand. But perhaps, you know, you're probably closer to that demographic age group than I am, Laura. Perhaps you've got a better sense of why it is that young people just get discouraged or not interested in taking the opportunity to get involved. I mean, I think, you know, we fought flip and hard to have the vote, and women particularly, and yet some of people just don't want to use it.
Yeah, I think I'm going to whip out my opinion here, but I think there should be a greater emphasis personally on our political system and our schooling. I think that would be a really great thing to see coming forward.
We have to make sure it's done without any political bias, of course.
Absolutely.
It has to be on the system and not what you should think and what you should look for, and that's always the risk.
No, that's absolutely, like, that's why teaching religion, for instance, is usually something that we keep within the home, because those ideologies you want to have parents teaching about. But I think it would be good to help engagement for those that potentially aren't getting that at home. Going to shift onto the fees-free conversation for tertiary that's been happening at the minute. So it's been labelled a failed election bribe. Why is that?
Yeah, look, we are not fans of the policy at all. I think it's a huge waste of a large amount of money that could have been far better allocated within the education system. We all know that there's, you know, quite a number of calls for funding within education, whether it's the quality of tertiary institutions and the way they're running. A lot of tertiary institutions have been running without any cost of living increases this year, and we want our universities and our polytechs to be, you know, top, cutting edge and well-ranked in the world. There's obviously demands around teacher shortages and teacher funding. There's demands around special education. So there's all sorts of areas where that money could have gone. And if the policy was designed to see more young people take up tertiary training, and not just universities, of course, this is apprenticeships and polytechs and training institutes and the like, if that was the goal of the policy, it's been a failure. I mean, where there's 2,500 fewer students enrolled in tertiary training. And the feedback I get, actually, almost unanimously around the country when this comes up, is that if the government did want to target some sort of fees reduction for students, why wouldn't you do it in the final year or upon completion of the qualification? Because I think the way I look at this is, when, you know, when the government's putting more money in, it's not the government, right? It's taxpayers saying there is a benefit to New Zealand in us having a more educated population, and I think everyone agrees with that. So if the benefit is in having people go through and, you know, complete their qualifications and get qualified in certain sectors, then we want to make sure that happens. I think it will be really interesting, for example, after this year, to see what the dropout rate is of first-year students who don't go on to complete or carry on with their training. And I think if we do see a spike in that, that will be another mark against this policy. But the other thing we've got to remember is that taxpayers are already funding 80% of the cost of a tertiary qualification. And, you know, I don't want to see cost ever be a barrier to someone getting an education. And I think with our student loans policy and that being obviously interest-free, it is available for people to take that up. I know living costs are tough. We've all been through that. I've got two kids at university at the moment. You know, it's an expensive process. Mm. But equally, I think students, the vast majority of them know that they're at university to get a qualification for themselves, to make, you know, to give themselves a better earning potential going forward. And I think it's important that they commit to that as well. So we see it as a fail. We see it as a poor priority within the education system. It hasn't resulted in more students. I think it's highly likely to result in certainly no increase in qualifications. And I think it's been targeted at exactly the wrong part of the system.
Mm. Well, I mean, in terms of incentivizing, I think having it at the first year is potentially good, again, opinion. But having it in the third year has the potential of excluding people who are only doing first year courses.
No, it would be in the final year of your training, is what I'm talking about. Yeah. So I agree there are 1 year courses, but if you sign up to do a 3 or 4 year degree and never complete it, how is that a benefit to New Zealand as a whole?
Mm. When we think about the education sector as well, universities in particular have said that they have not seen an increase in funding towards them for the last 10 years. Is it a matter of this spending happening at the wrong time?
Well, first of all, I would dispute that statement. I'd want to go back, but I think you would find that they have had increases. They may have failed that the increase hasn't kept up or what have you, but I would dispute the statement that they haven't had anything at all. But the other thing I'd point out, this comes up regularly, you've got to look at spending in terms of the situation of the country at the time. And when we were getting through the global financial crisis and the earthquakes and the like, and there was very little money to be invested, things were having to be run quite tight. Now we've got the country back into a situation where there are strong surpluses. This is where we have the time to go out and say, okay, now there is some money to go and invest in areas that haven't seen investment for some time. And then what the government, of course, is going to be judged on is how they prioritise that. And our argument strongly is $2.8 billion into this first-year free tertiary policy, which has resulted in fewer students, not more, was not the right place to put it and was a significantly wasteful expenditure when there are other areas that we think could have created far better value for money.
Mm. I also want to bring up what Labour had to say about their explanation for why this tertiary scheme hasn't brought in as much participation as they wanted. They said it's a result of the low unemployment rate, people having those options to get into the workforce sooner without a tertiary qualification. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't think that that holds water, really. I think most students now are recognising that, you're far better off to have some sort of tertiary qualification. And remember, this is not all about going off to university and studying law or medicine. Mm-hmm. This is as much about going into polytechs and, as you say, one-year courses at training institutions and apprenticeships and the like. I think most young people now realise that without anything post-secondary, it's very difficult. You can get a job, there's jobs to be had, but you're not going to be able to build a career on that. And actually, if you look back over the last few years, our unemployment rate has been very, very low for a couple of years, well down in the 4-4.5% range. So we've had low unemployment for some time. Yep, I know that the latest figure has been lower still, but it's not like we've had a period of very high unemployment. We've had consistently low unemployment for some years. And I don't think that that provides any sort of justification at all. I think that is a desperate attempt to create an excuse, but one that doesn't hold water.
Mm. I'm going to shift on to written parliamentary questions. So this is something that's just risen up. It's said that in this first year of Labour, or the coalition government, I should say, Labour has received 42,000 written parliamentary questions from National, which is double the amount that Labour gave in National's first year, the last round that National first came into government. This has raised a lot of criticism. What's your kind of response to that criticism?
Well, I think it's basically Labour just whinging because we have a strong and effective opposition holding them to account, and a lot of it, I have to say, they brought on themselves. So first of all, you've got to compare when Labour were in opposition in that first year of the National Government, from memory, and I stand to be corrected, they had something in the order of 26 or 27 MPs. Mm. We've had 56, so immediately you've got twice as many of us, and so, of course, there are going to be a lot more questions. Secondly, we're a very focused opposition who know their portfolios and across the detail and are asking government to provide a lot of the information that they haven't yet provided beyond sort of the high-level speeches. But thirdly, I can tell you, Laura, that in my own experience, when I've been putting questions in, and I put questions in exactly the same form I used to receive them as a minister, asking about briefings that have been received, for example, and let's say I put in a question asking for briefings that the Minister of Finance had received, and this is just an example, let's say it was the Reserve Bank Act reforms over the last month, and I'd get a response back saying you'll have to be more specific. So you'd go back and say, okay, well, can I have the briefings you've had over the Reserve Bank reforms for the last 2 weeks? And you get a response back, be more specific. So we got to the point where we were having to go back and ask for them almost on a daily basis. Now, that creates 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 questions, when if you had answered the first one, we would have got the same information. So I know as a minister that that's the form in which I answer them. And because Labor have been obfuscating and ducking and diving, we get all the same information eventually. But if it takes me 10 questions to get the same answer, then I'm not going to apologise for the fact that they've had 10 more questions than they should have. If they'd answered the question first time round, it would have saved everyone time.
So it's kind of this debate about whether this huge amount of questioning is making government inefficient or whether the government is already being inefficient.
I think the government is being reluctant to pass over information and trying to avoid their obligations around transparency, and they're now balking at those obligations. But as I said, if they provided the information up front, as it was asked for in the form that we provided to them when we were in government, then they wouldn't have those issues. Mm-hmm. The reality is that written questions are a really important part of our parliamentary democracy. And it's, as I say, it's Labor's own fault that they're not answering the questions. But also, when you've got twice as many MPs in opposition as we had compared to when Labor in opposition, you're going to have a lot more questions.
There's an Auckland University professor, Barry Gustafson, who's called this a fishing expedition. Is this a fair comment?
Well, what I would say to him is that he should compare the questions being asked with those being asked by Labor, and it is very, very standard for us to ask questions, not actually ask, not just us, the media do the same thing. We would get long OIA requests from the media or from written questions from the opposition asking us for all the briefings that have come to my office over the course of week, over the course of, say, the last week. That has not changed over many, many years, certainly all the time I've been in Parliament. And you get those briefings to see what the Minister is working on. The media do the same thing. And I suggest that Mr. Gustafson should go back and have a look at whether the nature of those questions has changed at all. And as I said, other than the government now forcing us to be very pedantic and almost asking for things on a day-by-day basis, then the nature of what's being sought either from opposition or the media hasn't changed at all.
I'm just going to finish off on my usual
non-political.
I try to move it away as much as I can, but we're actually speaking about feminism on the show today. And I was curious, are you a feminist?
Yeah, I think I am a feminist.
Yeah?
I mean, to me, absolutely. To me, I mean, that means different things to me, but to me it means believing that women should have every opportunity to do anything they want in life in a way that works best for them without judgment or prejudice. And I absolutely believe that and fight very hard for it. So if that makes me feminist, I'm proud to wear that label.
Oh, I love it. Beautiful, Amy. Well, we'll be talking with you next week.
Alrighty. See you, Laura.
See ya.
Bye.
The National Party's Amy Adams on 95 BFM.
The Wire.